tumbling down, pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found, drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed. Cares of the past are behind, no go, but I'll find just where the trail will wind, drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed.
In this episode, I speak with Betsy Gaines Quayman. She is a historian and conservationist. She has a doctorate in environmental history from Montana State University, and she is the author of American Zion: Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. I became aware of Betsy several weeks ago. I believe that there was an interview that was in High Country News in which she was talking about the Bundys, specifically Ammon Bundy, who is a well-known rancher, part of, course, the Bundy family. The interview specifically was talking about this family, these ranchers, and how they were reacting to the lockdowns in wake of COVID-19 and the pandemic. And that was a really interesting interview in which she got into the Bundy's relationship with Mormonism, with the LDS Church and that belief system, and how that belief system of the LDS Church informs the settlers in this region and their relationship with the land. I wanted to get a hold of Betsy because, of course, I come from this religion. That's part of my background. Of course, I'm no longer a part of it, but it did play a really important role in my upbringing. Every once in a while, I like to revisit this subject, take on the subject from different angles. Something that's been very fascinating for me, and I actually explored this in an episode I did with historian of American religion, John Turner. He was the author of Brigham Young, which is a biography of Brigham Young, the second leader of the LDS Church. Was something that we touched on in that interview, which was the fact that Brigham Young and his large group of followers, members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that when they migrated to what is now called Utah, to the American West, they were instrumental in the settler colonialist project, in Manifest Destiny, as it's also been called. This idea that white settlers have a right to occupy and settle and use the land that was, of course, once the territories of indigenous peoples. So in this interview, we get into that subject more deeply. Betsy's done a really great job in her book and in other work that she's done to explore the ways in which this theology of the Mormon Church has influenced the way that we deal with public lands, the way that we conceive of private property, of private ownership of the land out in the American West. When the Mormons came out here in the 1800s after the assassination, the murder of the founder of the church, Joseph Smith, and when Brigham Young took over as the leader, the Mormons were just really instrumental in that process. And the belief system that Mormons tend to have when it comes to their relationship with the land is playing out into the present day. We have, of course, large segments of the American West that is considered public lands, which is to say that it is managed by BLM, which is the Bureau of Land Management. And this includes lands that are largely untouched, but also national parks and national monuments. And so the Bundys, and I want to say this very clearly, and I think that Betsy does an excellent job of unpacking this in this interview, so I'll say this very briefly. The Bundys became well known in the last decade or so. Of note, in 2014 and in 2016. In 2014, Cliven Bundy, who is the patriarch of the Bundy family, he owns land down in southeastern Nevada. He apparently had fees, grazing fees, that he needed to pay off to the U.S. government because he's let his cattle graze on public lands. And some of these lands are, of course, protected for conservation purposes.
Today, protesters from as far away as Florida came to this stretch of desert road. Many are armed. They say they are here to support rancher Cliven Bundy.
I'm not fighting it alone. That's why all these people are here. It's all of your problem. Our freedoms are gone.
His family has raised cattle here for more than a century, but the herd roams across protected land owned by the U.S. government. Bundy has refused since 1993 to pay the Bureau of Land Management grazing fees many other ranchers pay across the West. He now owes more than $1 million.
The money's not the deal. The cows are not the deal. It's still, you got to understand, it's freedom and liberty and access to our land and get rid of this abusive government.
And ultimately, that conflict culminated in an armed standoff between the Bundys and other members of other groups, militia mostly, and, of course, the Bureau of Land Management and federal authorities.
Federal and state courts have ruled against Bundy. This week, the BLM began to round up his 900 cattle across an area the size of Rhode Island. That led to this confrontation on Wednesday.
No BLM!
Between the Bundy family, demonstrators, and federal agents.
Get out of here, you coward! Get out of here!
At one point, officers used tasers to subdue protesters they say tried to block government vehicles.
It didn't end in bloodshed, but it very easily could have. And also in 2016, where Ammon Bundy, the son of Cliven Bundy, who now lives up in Idaho, by the way, he had led an armed takeover of the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Central Oregon, and that did end in shots fired. I believe someone died in that conflict.
A violent development in that nearly month-long standoff in Oregon. The FBI and Oregon State Police arresting several armed militia who were occupying a wildlife refuge. This after a confrontation at a traffic stop. Shots were fired and one person was killed. Authorities telling us tonight that leader Ammon Bundy is among those taken into custody. This comes nearly a month after Bundy and other militants took over the remote refuge as part of a long-running dispute over public lands in the West.
This conversation is interesting because we're talking about the modern militia movement. We're talking about a far-right ideology that is founded in a sense of ownership of the land, and how ranchers like the Bundys interact with the landscape. That's a big part of this. And how Mormon theology has played an instrumental role in these trends that we're seeing to the present day. Again, I find this subject to be incredibly fascinating. Of course, I talk about settler colonialism on this podcast a great deal. I do touch on the LDS Church every once in a while. And to talk about this with Betsy, who understands the history of conservation, the fact that we are in a very unique moment right now where we're seeing American society at large fracturing in a way that we haven't seen in a very long time, with the massive protests that we've been witnessing in Minneapolis, with the killing of George Floyd, a black man, by a police officer, or by several police officers from the Minneapolis Police Department, seeing how the police and the state react to that in comparison to some of the militias and the various armed protesters that were largely white that were storming Capitol buildings just a few weeks ago in response to the economic shutdown with COVID-19. There is something really important there to examine, which is how the state deals with each of these groups of people. It's really fascinating. We get into all of this in this discussion. Betsy does a great job of unpacking this history, of explaining the theological underpinnings of their philosophy, of these ranchers. And it was really good. It actually starts, it's kind of interesting, you'll hear in a moment when I start this interview, it was actually Betsy that starts it off by asking me about my personal history with the church. We go from there. She's an excellent researcher and historian. I think her work is really important in understanding how the hell we got to where we are today, with environmental protections being stripped by the Trump administration, with the rise of the militia movements around the United States, and how Mormon theology plays a role in all of this. It's pretty damn fascinating and very captivating to listen to her talk about this. So again, Betsy, your work is amazing. Thank you so much for doing it. If you want to learn more about her work, I would recommend going to her website, BetsyGainesQuayman.com. I'll put a link to her website down in the description. I will also put a link to her book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West, in the description, along with a book that is a collection of essays titled The Earth Will Appear as the Garden of Eden, Essays on Mormon Environmental History. She contributed to that collection. So I'll put a link to those books in the description. And also, she mentions at the very end of this an organization called Wild Earth Guardians. Go to wildearthguardians.org. It's a really important nonprofit that deals with a lot of the issues that we discuss in this episode. Please go check out her work. She's doing really incredible stuff. Go support her and buy her book. I think that would be a good way to dig into these subjects if you find them interesting. That would be the best course of action. And before we jump into this, I want to say, if you want to learn more about this project, in particular this podcast, you can go to lastbornthewilderness.com. Go there. Everything you need to know will be on that website. If you want to support this project monetarily, you can do that through the one-time donation link through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. And if you want to support this project regularly, you can do that through Patreon. You go to patreon.com/lastbornin the wilderness. And to all the patrons of this podcast, thank you so much. Your support is huge. So I cannot thank you enough for your support in this work. So please consider doing that. Without any further delay, here is my interview with Betsy Gaines Quayman.
Here on the range I belong, drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweed.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about anything you want to talk about, and I really want to hear. Well, we don't have to do it right now, but it was very interesting to grow up in the LDS culture, and that's no longer a big part of your life.
Yeah, that was something I would at least mention at some point because, yeah, like you found out about me. I'll just say that, yeah, I grew up LDS. I left when I was in my late teens. I was like 18-ish when I kind of left it behind. And yeah, I mean, in a way, kind of the podcast, the title itself actually is a reference to a Book of Mormon passage because my dad would call me his last born in the wilderness in reference to the first, I think it was like the second book of Nephi or something like that, like one of the first books in the Book of Mormon because I'm the youngest of this big family. And then I kind of, as I started doing the work more, I realized there was all these ecological components to it, and there was kind of an apocalyptic quality to it as well, discussing ecological collapse and climate change and political stuff. So it's interesting. What instead of building resentment or hatred or a lot of the things that I think a lot of Mormon or former Mormons feel. Because it leaves such a huge hole in you when you leave. It's such a big part of your life. And sometimes, you know, I know a lot of people that have left, and I was lucky. I didn't have my family like disown me or anything. They're very supportive, but I know plenty of people where that's what happens is like they leave it and their family kind of cuts them out and there's all this conflict and fighting. Yeah. And I was lucky that that never happened. But I think even then when it is the best situation possible, you have this huge void and you don't know what to fill it with. So a lot of times people get angry and all of this stuff. And I had to work through that. So in a way, I've had to reflect on Mormonism throughout this podcast as a way of kind of making sense of it.
Yeah.
And so I've explored it numerous times. So I have no problem like talking about it during the interview.
Yeah. No, it's interesting because I have friends who are both still in the church and friends who have left the church who have expressed exactly what you said, that there was just an emptiness. It was really hard. And that they have had some difficulties with their family. But the one thing that I really tried to do with this book, because I think that others who've written about the Bundy family have I tried to be incredibly respectful of their beliefs. At the same time, acknowledging number one, they do not represent the church and their beliefs, and number two, that their beliefs are somewhat, clearly dangerous. So, but I wanted this book to be something that both people in the church and people outside of the church could read and understand without feeling alienated, because I think that there are writers out there that aren't fair to the Mormon church. And I know there are a lot of people the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and it means a lot to a lot of people. So I didn't ever want to come across as disparaging.
Yeah, well, you know, if you want, we can just keep on rolling here. I think we're going with this already. This is always how it goes when I start these things. It's like we start having a conversation before you know it, we're getting into it. So we'll just keep on going with this. But yeah, I think that that's really, it's really respectful of you to do that. And I appreciated that from seeing your TEDx talk, from reading what excerpts I've read of your book and other interviews that you've done, which is that you do a really good job of framing it. Like you just said, it's like, you acknowledge really clearly, you say very clearly that the actual church, the LDS church, does not, it's stated pretty explicitly that they don't endorse the Bundys and what they're doing, what they have done. And but you also have to acknowledge that their belief system is founded, it's rooted from the same place as where the church comes from. And so I think having that nuanced perspective is really important. You can't separate the two. It's not that easy. You can't just say, just because the LDS Church said, we don't endorse this, we don't endorse this family's actions, these ranchers, it still doesn't get them off the hook in the sense that there's still something very deep that they both have in common, and that's tied to the history of the church and settler colonialism out west in the what is now the United States. And that, to me, is what's been something I've tried to tackle, because I approach that in this podcast a lot, talking about settler colonialism. And the more I've analyzed my own history and where my family comes from and the LDS Church, I realized that the LDS Church has been instrumental in that expansionist project that is the United States. And so, yeah, I appreciate how you've approached the subject. I think you do it delicately and with a nuanced perspective. So I just wanted to say, I think you do really well at that.
Thank you. And your points that are coming up also, and you're really touching on the title of the book, which is American Zion, and the idea of Zion being Mormon homeland. And so when you had early church members come from places of real oppression, I mean, there was terrible violence in Missouri. Then Joseph Smith, the first Mormon prophet, put together the Nauvoo Legion, which was a militarized body. It was second in size to the U.S. Army. So it was a very large militia. And they came from when Joseph Smith was murdered. They were very angry and they were very highly organized in terms of their military capabilities. So they came to the Great Basin. And they had been promised by Joseph Smith, again, as you were talking about, early church ideas that still continue to influence the church as a whole, but particularly the Bundys. The Bundys have taken it to an extreme, that this land is sacred Mormon homeland, Zion. And so the book actually talks about the idea of American Zion, because we recognize these lands as public lands. They recognize these lands, and they meaning the Mormons and their support, or excuse me, the Bundys and their group of LDS supporters. And there are many supporters, particularly in these rural communities, that are members of the church as well. But they have this feeling of entitlement because it does go back to the claims of early Mormon settlers. So, you know, when I talk to Cliven and I get into this in the TED talk, his sense of history goes back to the time when the first LDS settler comes into the region and his horse drinks from a river, which the day before was a Paiute River. So his history starts with Mormon settlement and not, in this case, with the Southern Paiute, which are the traditional indigenous people in the area. And not to say that they aren't still there. The Southern Paiute are still there. But I do think these claims come from this absolute certainty that Joseph Smith, that Joseph Smith, hearing from God, was told that his people, his brethren, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints would have homeland and it would be theirs and it would be separate from the United States government. Because at that point, the United States and the Mormon people had a terrible relationship, one of violence and mistrust and deep, deep anger.
I remember growing up in the church, and yeah, that was emphasized over and over again, the conflict between wherever the Mormons settled, the communities that surrounded them, and also the U.S. government was a part of that. I think there was a governor of, Illinois, or was it Missouri? It was one of those states where the governor actually, like, ordered the U.S., maybe it was a state military to attack a Mormon settlement, and it was a really brutal takedown.
It was an extermination order that the governor of Missouri, Lilburn Boggs, issued, which essentially said, kill any Mormon person that you see. I mean, it was that order, although this starts to get kind of murky because he issued the order, but there were already so many mobs going after early Mormon settlers that it may not have come directly from this order. However, it happened right around the time that militia killed a number of people living in a place called, mobs, Missouri mobs, non-Mormons, killed Mormon people living in a place called Hahn's Mill.
Yeah, so there's like this very legitimate concern that Mormons had, which was that they were being persecuted and chased out of every region they settled in. And, I remember my first, after I left the church and I kind of started to deal with my feelings about it, I wanted to understand the history a little better because I felt like I wasn't told a lot of things. And digging into No Man Knows My History, I believe is the book title. It was like a big deal when it came out. She was a member of the church. What was her name?
Fawn Brody.
Yes, that's
Fawn
her name.
Brody. Yeah.
And she wrote that. She was excommunicated from the church because of it. But she's just a historian and did her best to accurately portray Joseph Smith and his early life, the best that she could with what records were available. But yeah, you really learn a lot, you know. I think what happens is the church, because they certainly were victims of extraordinary violence, but there were things that the church also did that was not good either, and or I should say the leaders of the church, like Joseph Smith, and you learn a lot reading that book. You kind of get a deeper idea of, like, I think what sticks out to me, and this is what I want to get into, is how it's interesting how they were in such conflict with the U.S. government, but in a way, I feel like Mormonism, the theology of the church, is such an American thing. It's like you couldn't see, there would never be a Mormon church in Europe or any other part of the world. It would only exist in the context of the United States with this sort of manifest destiny kind of ethic or drive that seems to be underneath everything. This idea of expanding, and that the North American continent was essentially for white settlers to just take, right? There's that sense of superiority and white supremacy and all of that that's layered in there. So it's interesting because I think, yeah, Mormons definitely were persecuted, but the leaders also did instigate certain types of conflicts that didn't need to happen. And again, it's complex. It's a complicated history. There's not...
And your points are really interesting. Yes, it's an incredibly... It's such an American thing. It came out of the Second Great Awakening. This was a time of religious fervor, speaking in tongues. There were all sorts of prophets, people claiming they were the second coming. And that came out of a time of great anxiety. Settling America. And again, you know, which included taking land away from indigenous people. It was a time of anxiety, certainly more so for the indigenous people. And so when Joseph, he was very much influenced by his upbringing, which was this kind of revival fervor, an area that they called the burnt over district, which meant that there were just ministers and revivals and people coming in and out with new religious ideas. And it was also a time of the millennial idea. So this kind of idea of, in his case, he talked about the Church of Jesus Christ of latter days. This was a time when the revelation was going to come into being, and we were going to see the apocalypse. And so these are all things that were taken by this culture and then put into to the Great Basin. And again, that whole migration from New York to Ohio to Missouri to Illinois, and then finally to the Great Basin. The way that the Mormon people organized themselves in the Great Basin required this separation from the United States. They had 10 years and between settlement and about 1857, where they were really able to unite, and they had this common theme of oppression. They really banded together. And again, you would have needed that sort of act of migration and moving into a space that was not occupied by other colonialists. Now, again, it was certainly occupied by a number of indigenous groups, and they set up permanent settlements, whereas the Ute and the Southern Paiute, the Navajo, the Shoshone, they moved around and so occupy these areas and prevent the sort of seasonal movement that the indigenous people were using or had that was their lifestyle. And I'll also add one more thing. You talk about how this is such an American religion. Joseph Smith, in essence, said that the Constitution was divinely inspired. He believed very deeply in the Constitution. He felt like the Constitution would protect, ultimately protect the Mormon people from religious oppression, especially the First Amendment. And so the Constitution, in essence, became part of the sacred canon, along with the Pearl of Great Price, the Book of Mormon, and Doctrines, Covenants, that sort of thing. So you have, and this is very essential to understanding the Bundys. The Bundys really feel like they understand the Constitution as members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints than people who are not in the Mormon Church, and that they have a special relationship. The other piece that also informs the Bundys, and again, this goes back to Joseph Smith and Revelation, is they feel like they're getting their orders directly from God. So you have a religion that does believe in prophecy, and that Mormon men can get messages from God. And I talk a little bit about that in the book. Joseph Smith at one point tried to, as John Krakauer said in Under the Banner of Heaven, put that genie back in the bottle because he didn't want to have competing prophecies. But nonetheless, you have people throughout the Mormon history who have gotten prophecy in addition to the prophet and the president at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like once, like you said, it's like once the genie's out of the bottle. Yeah. It's like no matter, I do remember at some point Joseph Smith did make some, I want to say decree, but I don't know if that's the right word for it. But basically said like, yeah, you know, you have to be of a certain position in the church to be able to have actual revelation from God. But again, I think once that was out there and considering the cultural context in which the church emerged, people were supposedly speaking in tongues and communicating with angels and God. And I mean, it wasn't just isolated to the church. I mean, this was a common thing throughout the Eastern United States with this religious revivalist period that was happening. What's fascinating is how this particular religion became so, how it grew and how it became, it stayed through time. We still have it to this day. It's one of the most powerful religions in the United States as far as, I mean, I remember, I think I saw somewhere that the church has how many billions of dollars? I can't remember what it is, but it's a very, very powerful organization in the United States and in the world. And I just find it really interesting how this particular religion stuck and managed to garner as many followers as it did over time. And I don't know, maybe, do you have any thoughts as to why that would be? I'm just curious, this question just came up, but I mean, what is your theory on why this church has been around so long?
I didn't mean to interrupt.
You're good. I'm just talking very slowly.
I think the church would never have been as successful as it was if Brigham Young hadn't taken over. I think Brigham Young was incredibly determined. I think he was really organized. He did not accept any dissension. There were a lot of people who were in the church disagreeing with Joseph Smith, over various things, in particular polygamy, and so there were dissenters. And you know, when Joseph Smith was murdered, the church split, and there were different parts of it. Brigham Young brought everybody together. He took them. They had the shared history. They worked their way across the United States to settle in the Great Basin. Not an easy place to settle. He would not tolerate anybody disagreeing with him. And there probably was I don't know if you're familiar with the Danites. They came out of Missouri, but there was a group of vigilantes that were in the Mormon church that would correct other Mormons if they in some way disagreed with the prophet at that point, Joseph Smith. But there was this culture of Dan Knight, you know, we won't tolerate you disagreeing with our prophet. And so they became so cohesive. They also had a common enemy, which was the United States. They had a vendetta. They wanted to avenge the blood of the prophet, which was Joseph Smith and his murder at the Carthage jail. And you just had a culture come together, get very determined. And then you had the missionizing, always bringing people in. And what Joseph Smith promised, and what Brigham Young promised, was, you know, you're going to come into a community. A lot of them were outside of the United States. You know, they were promised these, just like so many immigrants, they were promised this promised land. And, you know, they end up in the Great Basin, and there were many people who were extremely disappointed. They didn't have any money, but the church took care of everybody, and they grew their numbers. And I just think the circumstances, the history, the early church oppression, and this incredibly determined prophet really cemented the church, and they went from being very, very poor in a country that's pretty lean and hard to you know, make the desert bloom, as the people are always talking about, the Mormon people. They did, and they prospered, and each generation got a little bit better. You know, the first generation that got there had to deal with the locusts, and they had to deal with flooding, and they had to deal with any number of awful circumstances. But they continued to work together. They were very connected. They weren't integrated into outside. I mean, the Mormon people stayed with other Mormon people, and the church was very protective of that. Even in some of these early efforts, I write about in my dissertation, my book, American Zion, came out of my dissertation because I started looking at Mormon settlement. And one of the things that happened, for example, was in Zion National Park, there was an Easter pageant that happened in the 30s. And it was wildly popular, both with the local people as well as with people from the United States who would come to Zion National Park and celebrate Easter all together. Well, the church put the kibosh on that because they did not want Mormon people being influenced by non-Mormon people, even though everybody was Christian. And so there was a real there was a real effort to protect that culture. And then they became prosperous. And as I think you're referring to, there was a recent article, oh gosh, it might have come out right in December 2019 that the Mormon Church had been able to, I mean, again, this is a nonprofit, this is a church, but they had accumulated $100 billion in investments, and that was just one piece of their portfolio. Yeah. So this is an incredibly wealthy, incredibly successful faith. And it, again, it gets back to some of the things that we talked about before. Why haven't the Bundys been excommunicated? Who in the Mormon Church, who's powerful, still believes that their fight on the ground is important? And I think that we've seen Utah be one of the leaders in the state's rights efforts, that there are politicians in the state of Utah who are also members of the Mormon Church who are resentful that public lands in Utah, and I can't remember the percentage of public lands in Utah, but I want to say it's about 60%. In some counties, it's 90%. I mean, I think Garfield County, which is where Escalante, or the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument is, I think that might be up to 97% public land in that area. But because you have this notion of Zion, and because you have this notion of a culture that wants to do things without the interference of the American government, you have a very deep culture of pushing back against federal control, especially over lands that you view historically as your own.
Just to bring this up, I mean, with Trump as president, he has rolled back almost 100 environmental regulations during his presidency, or at least he's in the process of doing that. One of those things is to open up these lands, national monuments, national parks, these public lands that are supposed to be protected federally. He's opening them up for gas and just fossil fuel extraction and leases, mining, things like this, including, I think you mentioned, to say Grand Staircase. There's several sites in Utah in particular that are now being opened up for private use. And so I guess that's representative of the culture in Utah, at least in the state of Utah, the various representatives and various representatives in their Congress. And I assume that's a kind of a popular idea to, I imagine, open it up for private use. Is that right?
Well, it really depends. And this gets into some regional issues. The Bundys, and we should maybe say what the Bundys did so that people, yeah, in case they don't know. Clive and Bundy is a rancher in Bunkerville, Nevada, which is not very far from the Utah border. So he's in southern Nevada, and the lands that we're talking about right now are in southern Utah. They're all very close together, these public lands. But he stopped paying grazing fees in 1993 because he had been offered a deal to get a buyout because his land, which is in the Mojave Desert, had an endangered species that it was a tortoise that was being impacted by grazing. So Bruce Babbitt, who was the Secretary of the Interior at that point under Clinton, was able to create a sort of plan where the developers in outside of Las Vegas would put money into a fund as they developed their lands. They would buy out the ranchers' allotments so that the allotments would be habitat for tortoises and Las Vegas could continue to develop. And you could easily argue that that's incredibly unfair, that the ranchers were the ones that had to give up their land, whereas the developers were able to continue to develop in tortoise habitat. That said, the ranchers were compensated at a very fair level. I have a friend who took one of the buyouts and he did not like giving up his ranching or his public land allotments, but he said, "I was compensated fairly." Bundy didn't want to do it. He continued to graze his cows. They continued to trespass. He expanded his herd from about 150 to about 1,000. And again, I'll go back and say, this is the Mojave Desert. So this is not good cattle country. It's good tortoise country, but it's not humane necessarily for the cows in July and August in the Mojave Desert. And so his allotment had talked about how he moves the cows around and you know, he just had them there all the time illegally. And he was expanding his herds and he wasn't paying any grazing fees. So after this had been in and out of the court for a number of years, a judge finally ruled it was time for the cows to be confiscated. The BLM got ready to confiscate them. The Bundys, the family, called in the militia, which they broadly networked with militia across the country. Militia came to Bunkerville, Nevada, and there was a standoff between the Bundy family and their supporters and law enforcement. And it shut down the interstate for 2 hours. Traffic was at a standstill because guys had AR-15s aimed at sharpshooters, you know, government sharpshooters. It could have been an absolute massacre. It ended peacefully because the government backed down, the BLM backed down, which is the Bureau of Land Management, who was tasked with confiscating cows. I went to visit the Bundy the year after that happened, the Bundy family. And then the year after I visited them, Ammon Bundy and Ryan Bundy took over the Malheur National Wildlife Refuge in Oregon. And they had this 41-day siege where they the refuge was completely occupied. And so that's who the Bundy family is. Going back to your question about deregulations and that sort of thing, under the Trump administration, there are two things that happened. Number one, the Trump administration or people within the Trump administration, like William Perry Penley, who is head of the BLM now, is very much what you call, or what he calls, a sagebrush rebel, which is this war, you know, this decades long war over public land.
Could you say his name again?
Sure. It's William Perry Pendley.
Okay, thank you.
And he certainly, as the BLM, is not somebody who's going to take the Bundys to task. There's a great deal of lawlessness that's happening on lands, particularly in Utah and Nevada. They're not being monitored. Grazing allotments aren't being monitored. Cows are they're exceeding their levels of how many cows they have. They're exceeding the seasonal dates of how long cows can stay in certain areas, and that causes a great deal of damage. William Perry Penley, Trump's guy, is not going to enforce that. When you talk about the monuments, Bears Ears National Monument, which I think is a really important one to bring up, that was done collaboratively with five different nations and the federal government so that Native people could have a huge role in being a part of this national monument. And really, that's the model that we need to think more and more about, given that this is Native land, traditional Native land. And so there needs to be a far greater role in Native management of these lands. That monument was reduced by 85%. And that becomes open to, the extractive activities that you're talking about. The Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was reduced by, I believe, 47%. Again, open to extraction. So you have, and then to add a further layer to it, the head of the EPA, Bernhard, has completely deregulated everything during COVID because he wants to have economic activity on these lands. So we don't have nothing's being monitored right now. We're in a really bad situation in terms of the environment at this particular moment in history.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because it's like I've brought this up so many times since this pandemic began, but the idea of the shock doctrine or disaster capitalism, which is Naomi Klein wrote this really excellent book about this idea that in states of crisis, you have governments and often their business partners, capitalists, tend to take advantage of times like this to further certain things, like privatizing things or, you know, grabbing land for private use. So under this guy, I mean, in the COVID-19, this pandemic is absolutely real and we should take it seriously, but it's just like with any crisis, we see massive deregulation, we see things like you just mentioned, right? So I just wanted to make that point that, yeah, if we thought it was bad before the pandemic started, it seems like it's only accelerated during the past several months, 2 months or more. Yeah.
It has. I mean, it absolutely has. They've used this to unravel, our laws, essentially. Mm-hmm. I did want to mention, did I see that you're in Idaho?
You didn't say that, but I am in Idaho. Yeah. Yeah.
Where are you in Idaho?
I'm in southern Idaho. I'm in Twin Falls County. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I talked to, last night I was able to talk to the community library in Ketchum. Mm. And we were talking a little bit about what was going on in Idaho right now, because as you know, Ammon Bundy has moved to Emmett, Idaho. And so yeah. He's...
And I think I just wanted to clarify, sorry to interrupt you, but Ammon is the son of Cliven. Is that correct?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I just want to make that clear.
Who took over the Malheur Wildlife Refuge.
Right. Okay.
So, you hadn't told me that. I was looking at your show and your program, and yeah. I wanted to check you out, and I'm really impressed with this program. I think it's so wonderful.
Thank you.
But I talked to Ammon mid-March because I knew this was going to be a trigger. I knew this was something that he was going to start using to agitate. And, his concern is Governor Brad Little, who is the governor of Idaho, his stay-at-home orders, which were really, really, he was very responsible early in the response to COVID because of Blaine County. And Blaine County is where Valley is. It's a big tourist destination. And your state very early on had an explosion of COVID positive cases because of the tourism or the tourists that were coming into Blaine County. Now, Ammon, when I talked to him, said, you know, I understand shelter at home and you take care of each other. We'll take care of each other. I'm glad to be with my kids. 2 weeks later, he was trying to have these big Easter gatherings. He was getting involved with a man in Utah named Eric Mustos, who wanted to have big protests in Utah to push back against governor's orders to rest, shelter at home. But one of the things that Ammon and I talked about was that during these crises, the government uses them to consolidate power. And it was probably the only time that I agreed with him. And because he was worried that he wasn't going to be able to, businesses weren't going to be able to open. I feel like he latched onto the wrong issue, that, you know, here he's agitating to have businesses open before we know it's safe, or, you know, to not wear masks. I mean, he didn't believe that the mortality rates were as high as they were. He was worried about people's liberties in terms of, you know, I mean, again, not to say that this isn't an economic, a deep crisis for people, and it's terrifying, and that people are chomping at the bits to get their businesses back open and start working. I completely understand that. But his focus was there, and I don't think it's a smart idea to get huge gatherings together to protest at this particular moment in history. My concerns are more what we were talking about. What is the government doing in a case of crisis to deregulate on one hand, but also consolidate power? And I am worried, and I think it legitimately so, that the Trump administration is starting to think about how this will impact the elections, especially because his numbers are going down. Trump's numbers are going down. He's fighting against mail-in ballots. There was a case of the Department of Justice going to Congress to see if they could arrest people indefinitely without habeas corpus during this time. And so you see those kind of things and you think, okay, we are sheltering in place, but we better be careful because, crises are used to do nefarious things.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, something that I've I don't know as much about as I would like, but something that I think you do definitely dig into is the relationship the Bundys have, and I guess this, the Bundys have with the militia movement here in the United States. How deep are those ties? And if you could maybe give us a little bit of background on the militia movement in the United States and how the Bundys align with some of those values that they have.
Right. They are very aligned with the militia movement. And, you know, again, the militia movement, they're not necessarily an across the board, sort of unified force. There are very many different militias. They're the Proud Boys that you see in Michigan coming to the Capitol, Lansing with their AR-15s and threatening the government there. And by the way, that Donald Trump tweets "Liberate Michigan," so they feel like they're getting messages from Donald Trump directly. So you see that they are in contact with the Bundy family. The Bundy family had a number of different militia groups come and assist with the what they call the Battle of Bunkerville. That's the standoff that I was talking about. The three percenters are in Idaho. There are many three percenters who have been involved in the Nevada standoff, but there was also some three percenter involvement in Malheur, although it wasn't as much as the what happened in Nevada. Some of them are motivated by white supremacy. Some of them are constitutionalists. That's where the Bundys and the militia overlap. Is this the idea that they're the ones responsible for protecting the Constitution, that it's their job to defend the Constitution. If that means armed, pushback, that's what they're going to do. You see that they wear these pocket constitutions, and those pocket constitutions come from an organization that was founded by a Mormon and I guess philosopher, I might, Cleon Skousen.
Oh, yeah.
Who motivates a lot of people in the militia movement, whether they understand he's Mormon or not. He's been embraced by Glenn Beck, who became LDS after finding the writings of Cleon Skousen. Again, Cleon Skousen felt like the Constitution was the end-all be-all, that it falling into his faith was a sacred document, that the government cannot own public lands. That was something that he espoused, although that's been proven untrue in a number of court battles. So there is a very firm footing that the Bundys have within the broader militia network in the United States.
Mm, okay. Yeah, it's been disconcerting, to say the least, with the lockdowns that we've seen around the United States. You have armed people either in militias or associated with militias, or they might as well be a part of a militia. They're carrying assault rifles into, say, like the Michigan Capitol building, threatening the governor to reopen the state. We've seen this in other parts of the country. There were similar type rallies, or a rally similar to it, maybe not as extreme, but up in Boise, Idaho. I'm seeing this all over the United States. It's like, it just seems to be a fundamental aspect of American society at this point, that there are these gun-wielding men, basically, that will show up and say, hey, you know, we want to reopen the states for the economy and everything. But it's like, it's just very peculiar. And so I just wanted to get your insights into how prominent these militias are, and how the Bundys fit into that as well. Yeah. And I think you did a good job explaining that, though.
Well, and I, just to your point right there, it's so weird that people have conflated these restrictions to keep them safe, to keep vulnerable members of our community safe, with the Second Amendment. How has that been mixed up? No one has said, we're taking your guns away. We're saying there's a disease. We don't understand how it operates. Early information said that it would only affect elderly and vulnerable. It turns out that it affects every, you know, every age, healthy people. We're trying to determine how to handle it. And all of a sudden you feel like your right to bear arms is being threatened. And so you're right. This whole kind of cultural rabbit hole, this conspiracy, this misinformation, this fear, this white entitlement, you know, you see white people bringing guns to these protests. It's scary, and it also is working to Trump's base. It's something that, you know, anger, and sort of this the enthusiasm that comes about in protest.
Yeah, and I just wanted to draw the parallel here, because while those protests happened over the past month or so, you know, there was a shooting, or not, sorry, not a shooting, a police officer killed George Floyd in Minneapolis just a couple days ago, and there's been massive protests by largely black people in that city, of course, with others. And it's just interesting to draw the parallel, to see the difference in reaction by the police. So you have armed people, white people, going into state capitol buildings demanding that they reopen the state with little to no consequences, as far as I can tell. No one was arrested. There was really no confrontation between the police and these white protesters, these men with assault rifles. And then you have an actual group of people that are being oppressed by the state in a very real way. And when someone dies, like as it happens over and over again, when a black man is killed by the police, you have, I think, a very necessary reaction to that. And you see how the police tend to react to that, which is with rubber bullets, tear gas, and, and, you know, all that. So it just shows how we're all kind of, I see our society as being so deeply fractured, and it always has been, but I see those fractures deepening as we speak, and where you have whole groups of people that are actually experiencing oppression and reacting to that, and they're facing violence from the police. And then you have a whole other group of people that feel like they're being oppressed, when it's just all they're asking is, like, please just don't infect each other with this virus. That's it.
Right. And that's, I've been thinking exactly these same things. I mean, when George Floyd, who wrote a bad check, that's why he was being detained. Okay. So that's his crime, petty. And he's essentially, you know, and I'm not sure what I mean, it sounds like maybe a broken neck, or his windpipe was
crushed.
So he was killed. He was killed by police. The police in Lansing didn't do anything to these men who are screaming and yelling with these giant assault weapons in their hands. And it's stunning in how unfair our justice system is in this country, and what white people can get away with. And it's been unbelievably upsetting to me. A few days ago, I came across a post which I think really sums it up, and this goes to what you were saying. Being inconvenienced is not being oppressed.
Yeah, I think it speaks to how privilege impacts your worldview. You don't really actually know what it's like to be oppressed in any real sense. I mean, there's an intersectional approach where you acknowledge, like, class and all of these things, that's important. But when we're talking about actual police terror and violence that black communities have experienced since the police were formed in the United States, it's incomparable. You know, being inconvenienced is not the same as being oppressed. And so I just had to highlight that, the juxtaposition there, seeing those images of white protesters with guns going into, to Capitol buildings demanding that we reopen the economy, and seeing black people and others protesting, rightfully so, and experiencing just a disproportionate level of violence as a result. So I just had to make that point.
No, and I'm so glad you did. You can also say the same thing for Standing Rock and Malheur. You know, Malheur were, they were white people taking over a refuge with guns. Standing Rock were peaceful protests by indigenous communities trying to protect their water. And, you know, that, that, and I think it's the Sioux. But I have a friend right now who's writing a book, Jackie Keeler, about the difference between what happened at Standing Rock and what happened at Malheur, and the differences in the way that those groups were treated. It's a race issue. There's so much injustice.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I want to pivot to this point I wanted to get to. And, you know, you mentioned, of course, Standing Rock, which was an issue about protecting water, protecting this resource that indigenous people in that region absolutely feel a right to have. They should have access to clean water, and the rights of supposedly of corporations should not supersede that. So I guess my question is, when we talk about the Bundys and we talk about settler colonialism out west, I mean, in your view, I'm really curious about your thoughts about how this settler colonialist belief, I guess the beliefs that inform settler colonialism and also Mormonism, and with the Bundy specifically, how that informs their relationship with the land itself. Like, you talked about having the Clive and Bundy with his cattle in the deserts of Nevada, how that is not, there's a lot of issues with ranching in general, but to have cows in a region like that just seems completely insane to me. But that seems to be the reality that we live in, where we have cattle in places grazing on land that really they shouldn't be grazing on. It seems ecologically destructive. And so anyway, to kind of sum it up into a question for you, I mean, what in your research did you find that pointed to the philosophical or theological relationship that Mormons or settler colonialists have with the land in general?
Well, this needs to be kind of pulled apart a teeny bit, because there are a number of indigenous ranchers in that area. Are there, you know, I talked to a guy who I really, really liked. He was head of the Moapa band of the Southern Paiute. And his name was Greg Anderson, and he grew up ranching in the same place that the Bundys are now running cows. And so there are native ranchers who have ranched traditionally in these areas. And have come up against, you know, government regulation and have had problems with the government. Now, the Bundys have because they've been doing this illegally for so long, there's a very big difference between indigenous ranchers and the Bundys, who have broken the law and gotten away with it. I would definitely agree that there are places where on public lands where there just shouldn't be cows. I mean, I also have rancher friends that I think do a fantastic job and really, really take all precautions to make sure that their animals, both they're raised humanely, but also that they are very, very gentle on the earth. Public ranching needs to be reformed. It's heavily subsidized. It's not ecologically sustainable. I think that needs to really be tackled on public lands. But what you're talking about in terms of the cultural ways of looking at landscape, I really feel like LDS historically have looked at landscape as a built landscape. That's how it's made sacred. So it needs to be utilized in order for it to be pleasing to the eye of God. That's the traditional point of view. That was, you know, when Joseph Smith talked about building the city of Zion, it was a built landscape. It was not a natural landscape. And so the idea of reservation or protected areas does come up against Mormon worldview. That said, I think that it's really important to make the distinction between rural communities and, say, the church members in Salt Lake. There are a lot of LDS that are big conservationists and absolutely adore public lands in southern Utah and Nevada, in which case Nevada, I should say, that's the Gold Butte National Monument, which he should not have cows in, but it was a monument that was designated by Barack Obama, like the Bears Ears. So I do think that there's some real cultural differences. I do think that there's a reverence for natural landscape within the Southern Paiute communities. There are, if you go to Gold Butte, you see any number of petroglyphs of bighorn sheep. They were revered within that community, and so there's very different ethics. And I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, I just find it. It's fascinating to sort of draw at the roots of this and where it comes from. I guess maybe I could ask this. It's a bit of a historical question, but what has the LDS Church, let's say, when Brigham Young and his followers settled in the West, I mean, what was their relationship with indigenous peoples in this area?
Yeah, and this is a really good question because, and it's something I talk about quite a bit in my book. Brigham Young was the governor, but he was also the territorial Indian supervisor, is what his title was. And so he had the obligation or the responsibility of having relationships with the tribes. And he acknowledged that the Mormon people were taking over tribal lands. There are some arguments to suggest, or some scenarios to suggest, that Mormon people actually were much better than other white people at Indian relations. I as you know, the Lamanite, the idea of the Lamanite in the Book of Mormon is those are indigenous people, and there's a relationship between the Mormon people and indigenous people. There still are horror stories, stories of indoctrination, stories of taking Native children into homes and separating them from their families. But one of the things that Brigham Young did, and it was based on his relationship, particularly with the Southern Paiute or the Mormon people. In this case, it would have been Joseph Hamblin, although he's the one who was able to really create relations with the Southern Paiute. There was a warm relationship between the Southern Paiute and the Mormon people because the Southern Paiute had been a very vulnerable tribe to other tribes, and they were often taken as slaves and sold to Mexico. So the Mormon people actually offered some protection. The Southern Paiute were talked into participating in one of the darkest chapters in Mormon history, which was the Mountain Meadows Massacre. And this was a reflection of the terrible relationship that the Mormon people had with the U.S. government. You know, this was 10 years after 10 or 11 years after Joseph Smith had been killed. The U.S. government was in the situation where the American people were quite upset about both polygamy and slavery, and they wanted them to take action. And the government was reticent to take on the Southern states at that point, but they felt like they could target the Mormons and deal with polygamy at a lower cost. And so they sent this is called the Utah War. They sent the cavalry to Utah to take on the Mormon people and fight polygamy. The Mormon people reacted, or the LDS, the saints reacted, and they secured their borders. They didn't allow the army in, but one of the targets that their ire really landed on wagon trains that were moving back and forth, you know, or rather, to California. One party was called the Baker Fancher Party, and they experienced this rage that the Mormon people had for non-Mormons, for the U.S. government. 120 people were murdered by the the Brigham Young, through his agents, had convinced Native groups to attack wagon trains. The Southern Paiute were among them. Mormon leaders asked the Southern Paiute to participate in this raid. They were promised to get all the spoils, the supplies and the livestock and whatnot. But the Mormon people were the ones who led the massacre, and it lasted far longer than they expected. They really expected to kill this group of men, women, and children really quickly, but these were a very determined people. The siege lasted for 5 days. Finally, a man named John Doyle Lee, who was a very well-established Mormon leader who had a relationship with Brigham, very good relationship with Brigham Young, convinced the party to surrender, but it was under false circumstances, and there were a number of saints that took them along the trail and killed them, and some of I think the kids that were under 8 years old that survived the siege were taken into Mormon homes, and then later they were given back to the family.
Mm.
The relatives of the families.
Okay. Well, this is interesting. So, I mean, I think earlier we were talking about Joseph Smith, and there was this, I think you said Danonites, I believe. Is that their
yes.
name? Yeah. So there is a long history in the church of militias, of having some sort of armed resistance or defense against, say, the U.S. government or other mobs that wanted to attack members of the church. And I think it's interesting because when I think about the mainstream Mormon church, I don't think about any of that. There's nothing about it that elicits that feeling like, oh, they're militant and all of this. But there is, in the history of the church, a strong there's a history there with militias. So do you feel that maybe the Bundys and other maybe other Mormons or those of adjacent to the church, because I think there's a lot of offshoots of the church now,
mm-hmm.
That basically that sort of militant, those militant ideas, I mean, they've still passed through. Do you think there's a direct connection between, say, the Bundys and the early church history regarding those militias?
I do. I mean, I just think that's part of the culture. That's part of the early church history. Now, I don't think mainstream Mormonism has that. I think that this is something, in particular, this area, Mountain Meadows is not very far from Bunkerville. And one of the participants in Mountain Meadows is a man named Nephi Johnson, who is Clive and Bundy's spiritual great-grandfather. Clive and Bundy's grandfather, Johnny Jensen, was adopted by Nephi Johnson when he married, and I believe that Johnny Jensen's mother was Nephi Johnson's third wife or second wife. In any case, you know, he brought up Nephi Johnson when I was down there, and we talked about it for quite a while when I visited their home. And then I went back and looked at who Nephi Johnson was. He was actually probably the first white man in Zion Canyon, which is such an amazing geological and now tourist designation. I mean, it's absolutely magical place. This is something, you know, again, it informs this culture. So the people who were involved in the Mountain Meadows Massacre, many were part of the Nauvoo Legion, which, as I said earlier, was at one point the second largest army next to the U.S. Army.
Mm, okay. Yeah, it's just absolutely, it's just fascinating, but I think, I mean, for me, it feels a little too close to home to sort of just sit there and observe it as like an objective bystander, because it's, I mean, I am here in Idaho and I do come from the Mormon church. And so it just hits a little bit close to home here when I start to, you know, come back to this with you, talking to you in particular about it. I don't know. It brings up some interesting feelings that I don't know how to quite define or give name to yet, but I guess I'll ask this. We've been talking for about an hour now, and I'll just ask you this. I mean, some people feel uncomfortable making any sort of predictions or like trying to look into the future at all. But I mean, you've interacted with the Bundys, and of course you've written a book about them and the roots of this. Where do you think this is leading? What do you think their goals are ultimately in this struggle? Where do you think maybe realistically it could lead in the coming years?
You know, I have sleepless nights thinking about this. When I first visited them, I thought they were a small little offshoot, like an anomaly, you know what I mean? And it's turned out that they're much more connected and powerful than I ever thought that they would be. I also see the militia movement growing as well. I think that we're in for some real bumps. And I wish this wasn't true, but, you know, I've thought about if we do have free elections, and I'm hoping that we can figure this out because there's so many people who are so eager to vote right now. And if Donald Trump loses, I think we're going to see I think we're seeing like dress rehearsals right now with this COVID thing.
Yep.
And so, I don't know, the Bundys aren't the ones showing up with the guns. But one of the things that did that rattled me was that there was a woman in Meridian, Idaho. Her name was Sarah Brady. She's an anti-vaxxer. She intentionally went to a park in Meridian, and had her children playing there. An officer came and politely asked her over and over again to leave the park. She continued to ratchet up her irritation, and I mean, she wanted to get arrested, and so finally was arrested. And then Ammon Bundy, as I said, as we've made the point, Cliven's son, showed up at the arresting officer's house with dozens of people protesting this officer, menacing him, saying, "I want to serve papers." So I worry about. I we've talked about it on both sides. The law enforcement that we saw with George Lloyd and how awful that was. And then we're talking about law enforcement that was doing their job to protect the people and how the Bundys have menaced him. I am worried about law enforcement. Because there is going to be a time where they can't just let these guys get away with it. I'm very worried that there will be violence.
Yeah, it's a complicated issue for sure, and it speaks to just how we live in we live in a space right now. I think in this time, there's a lot of contradictions. It seems like it's not. We can have our convictions about things, but there are always going to be certain exceptions. You know, there's always going to be things that come up that confuse us or make us, hopefully, I mean, the idea is to be open-minded and open-hearted, but especially in a time as difficult as right now, it's unfortunate, but people are getting more and more locked into their little ideological worldviews. And it's like people are going to die for them, basically, you know, and if you have a sizable portion of the population that are willing to do what the Bundys have been doing or what they're or those that are associated with the movement that the Bundys are a part of, because it's not one thing, like you said, it's a lot of different things connected to each other. But I do see a deep fracturing taking place. And I don't know what to make of it yet. I don't know what the future holds either, but I think your point of view there is, I think, very spot on. You know, there are reasons to be worried about just even looking at this upcoming election in November.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens, but of course I hope for the best, but I'm not necessarily very optimistic either. Yeah.
I hope for the best too, because, you know, the best possible case scenario is that this brings us together and we really reflect on what we've been doing wrong. I mean, I don't want to sound woo-woo because I don't feel woo-woo, but I do think that there are a lot of people who may look at this in a way that's a reset, that there may be reconciliation possible. I'm not really sure what to do with them. I think they're very dangerous. I think they're very fractious. But I think most of the people in the United States, want to, you know, be collaborative, be together, you know, find common ground. I think most people in the West want to protect public lands. You know, again, that's going back to my book. So, you know, I'm hoping that their rational minds prevail. But the thing that worries me is that there are irrational people with a lot of guns.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's just the reality of the situation we're in. You know, I think we can just to end it this way, but it's sort of this thing where I see things happening somewhat simultaneously, which is that people are doing the woo-woo thing that you're talking about. They're coming to terms with the reality that we're in. They're asking, I think, my view is many people are beginning to ask the right questions about this crisis, you know? But I'm also seeing the exact opposite of that. I'm seeing people do really terrible things and act very selfishly, and they're very myopic and narrow-minded, and I see that happening as well. I see both things. It's confusing, and I don't know what to make of it, because I think as human beings, we really want a clear vision or narrative that we can understand the realities that we're a part of. But it seems to me that we have multiple narratives that are competing with one another more and more aggressively right now. And that's part of the fracturing I see. This is the last question I wanted to ask. Are you still in contact with the Bundys? Like, have you had these type of frank conversations with them? Have you expressed your views on what they're doing and what it's ultimately leading to?
The last time I talked to Ammon, I don't think they've read my book. as I said at the beginning of this conversation, I hope that I'm really fair with them. When I first talked to them, I was in the middle of my dissertation, so there was an ethics issue. I couldn't talk to them about the Battle of Bunkerville, the standoff. I stuck completely with theology, so we talked about their Mormon beliefs. I've talked to Ryan a couple of times. He was there at the first meeting, so I was with Ryan, Carol, and Cliven. And I was with them for about 3 hours in their living room. And then I've seen Ryan at a couple of gatherings, sort of these rallies that they have. And I talked to Ammon. He was a keynote at a rally in Modesto, California, and that was in 2018. And then I just talked to him again in March. As I said earlier, I actually, at that point, he was not doing these, you know, really trying to buck the system and break these stay-at-home restrictions. He was kind of playing around with it. But I did agree with him the last time I talked to him about the government, the dangers of government consolidating power. I said, you know, that actually is a concern of mine as well. So, you know, I've spent time with Shauna Cox, who is one of the Bundy's big supporters, and she was part of the Battle of Bunkerville as well as the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. You know, I mean, we've been very cordial with one another. So, you know, I don't have at this point any reason to think that. I mean, we come from extremely different points of view.
Yeah.
I feel like what they're doing is it's lawless, and it's dangerous, and it's an affront to you know, as they always say, we're we the people. And I think actually no, you're only we the people who agree. You know,
with you.
And so. It's hard. But at this point, I wouldn't say that there's any, I have only been treated with respect.
Yeah. Well, that's good. And from, my understanding of your work is that, they were pretty open with you and expressing, they're not ashamed of their points of view. They're willing to share that with anyone willing to listen. I just want to say I'm very happy that you were able to accomplish what you have with your book and your work. And I think it's going to be increasingly relevant over the years as we begin to see these bumps, as you mentioned, in the road, as we proceed further into these uncertain times that we're in. I think your book provides enormous amount of historical context to this this phenomenon, you know, that we're seeing right now. So yeah, I just want to thank you so much for talking with me. And I mean, I know we have your website, BetsyGainsQueeman.com. I'll put a link to that in the description, and also a link to your book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. You also contributed to, it was a collection of, I want to say essays, but that's probably not the right way to say that. The Earth Will Appear as the Garden of Eden. Oh, it is essays. Essays on Mormon environmental history. You've also contributed to that. So I'll put links to those books in the description of this episode. Is there any other resources you'd like to point people towards?
You know, I will say one little thing. I am part, I just joined the board of Wild Earth Guardians, and they're doing amazing things to take care of public lands right now. They're suing the Trump administration on a number of the issues that we talked about during this program, these essentially, you know, just disobeying environmental laws. If people want to help protect public lands and help push back against this unraveling, Wild Earth Guardians is a fabulous organization to support, and they, like every nonprofit right now, really need help.
Okay.
So that would be the one other I'd mention.
Yeah, I'll put that down there as well. Make sure people check
Thank
it out.
You.
Yeah, well, Betsy, it was really great to get to know you better.
You too. Mark, this has been fabulous. I really have appreciated this.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Last Born in the Wilderness. If you would like to support this project monetarily, here are a few options. You can send a one-time donation through PayPal. Go to paypal.me/lastbornpodcast. And you can treat that like a bit of a tip jar. If you like this episode, or any other episode of this podcast in particular, consider throwing a few bucks Patrick's way. That would really be helpful. And if you would really like to sustain this work and support this project more regularly, consider supporting this project through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/lastborninthewilderness and donate to the production of this podcast for $1 or more a month. And by doing that, you'll gain early access to these interviews and discussions before the official public release. And you will also gain access to some exclusive content there as well. As the great psychedelic bard Terrence McKenna said, "Take it easy, dude, but take it."
Keep rolling along. Deep in my heart is a song. I belong, drifting along with a tumbling tumbleweed.